You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 29th of December 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is actually the only Daily Nationalist of this week, and we do have with us today geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org, but we are not going to be talking about geopolitical issues. We are going to be talking about his new book. Matt, good day, sir. Merry Christmas. I hope you're well. How are you doing?
And Merry Christmas to you. Yeah, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this has been a pretty good year. And this book is a part of that.
It's excellent, Matt. Really, really good. I asked a relative to purchase me a copy for Christmas, and I just couldn't put it down. It took me 3 days to read it. It's just absolutely fascinating. It covers a lot of the stuff that I've found most interesting in your Orthodox Nationalist podcasts, and it's basically against nominalism. And let me see whether I can find a correct way to describe it here. Nominalism basically says that everything exists as an individual. It's unconnected, and the only time a connection appears is when man puts a connection onto it and says, well, this is related to this, or this is a part of this system here, this is a part of this species of cat. Whereas the original way of looking at things was that these systems had to have existed first, because everything is interconnected in the same way that all the organs are interconnected in a human body. There are various systems that are interconnected, like you need to have worms to break down a tree to create the soil for the seed to grow in the soil into a tree again. So everything is connected. You can't have one thing without another. And in order for that to be so, then the concept of these systems, the idea of these systems, has to exist first. And the very concept of a system, the order that is in that system, that's logos, another word for Christ, or one of the forms that Christ can take. And when we see that order in creation, that's when we see God in creation. So our religion and our faith is based upon reason, and it's based upon this order that we see within creation. And I mean, the way that I've looked at things for quite a while now seems to be in tune with this, because I've said quite a while back that, the earth itself, and it could appear to be millions and millions of years old, but the world itself could only be 7,000 years old, because Adam was created as a fully grown man. The Bible tells us he was created as a fully grown man. It wasn't a baby that then grew. It wasn't an individual on his own. It was mankind from that time. And from thinking about that Adam was created as a fully grown man, that means that the world was created as a fully grown world. So the world would have looked as if it had always been here. Everything that was required would be here. Things could not evolve from one thing into another in a vacuum. Everything has to be created together, and everything is a part of where it is in geography. And all of these ideas, that some of them are ideas that I've had myself, as I just pointed out there, with Adam as a fully grown man. But it all ties in with these ideas that you're talking about in this book, and it fits in with nationalism as well, where you can't have an individual that's separated on its own. You end up with a nation, and the individuals are a part of that nation, and the individuals cannot exist without the nation. We rely on a community for absolutely everything. So it ties in with nationalism, nationalist philosophy, and you're saying that this all goes back to the church fathers, and this was their argument against this horrible nominalism, which has resulted in evolution and all the evils of today. So would I be describing it correctly there, Matt? Have I understood what you're trying to get across correctly in the book, first of all?
Yes, in fact, that's an excellent way to describe it. The church fathers, or these were, you know, overwhelmingly Greek theologians and philosophers, took Plato as the intellectual, not the theological, but the intellectual foundation. And speaking of which, it was the Adam and Eve concept. But I can't remember the first time I read about this, but there has to be something, a universal human nature, in order for the incarnation or even the expulsion from the garden to make any sense. Christ is God, and he has taken on human nature. Now, he physically took the form of an individual man, but the whole point, and there's really no other way to understand it, the point of the incarnation was to connect human nature to the divine nature. That's why Christ, and there was all these battles at the time, the debate between how those two natures work together. Is there two wills or one will? What is the nature, etc.? But you have to have this universal concept of human nature, or else the incarnation doesn't make any sense. What was damaged when Adam and Eve fell? Well, it couldn't have been them just as individuals. It had to have been something far more universal than that. Human nature itself was damaged. But then if you're talking about nature, you're talking about universal objects, a universal thing that's instantiated and each individual human being. Now, Aristotle would say that's, you know, both reason and freedom, two sides of the same coin. And if you don't have, as a matter of course, either one of those, you don't have a human being. I don't care, what the object looks like. It could look humanoid, but if it doesn't have those things, the center of human nature and hence natural law, they're not human. And you mentioned something else, which is really important. There really are two ways of going about knowing something. The empiricists, which really led the Enlightenment, just after the Renaissance with Thomas Hobbes and people like that, knowledge comes through observation. And this an elite intellectual class decides what a species is, what an object is, just from putting pieces together. People like Darwin and Locke, they didn't really believe in say, species of animal. This was just a utilitarian, convenient way to group things that kind of look alike, that things are nothing but their qualities. Cats are nothing but their teeth and their fur and whiskers and things like that. But Plato, many centuries earlier, had rejected this idea, which existed in ancient Greece, was a sophistic idea. The sophists believed in it, that there really is no connection between a label that we use and any kind of universal object. It's just an abbreviation. So we group things together because they have certain things in common. But that's a human creation. That's simply an abstraction. But then you look at, Plato was a mathematician, which is not an accident. Numbers, geometric laws exist, whether or not they're ever instantiated in matter or not. They have to. And you mentioned the evolution. One of the best arguments against evolution is the discovery of DNA. In fact, I have no idea how that system of thought ever survived the discovery of DNA. I mean, even in the simplest cell, these strands have billions of pieces of information in an extremely delicate, they almost have their own civilization and language, that DNA and RNA and all of the proteins and chemicals communicate. And if any piece of it is off balance, nothing could exist. That means that these laws, this information has to predate matter, or at least have been created at the same time. In other words, the laws of genetics couldn't have developed. That doesn't even make sense. The laws of evolution, so-called, couldn't have developed. They had to have existed at the exact same time that matter was created, even in the simplest and most primitive kind of cellular structure. In other words, and you mentioned the systems. Again, a very powerful argument against that kind of, you know, Darwinism is just a very extreme version of nominalism. And it's not an accident that it occurred during the height of the British Industrial Revolution and its empire from London. It was music to their ears to hear someone like Darwin. But systems have to come first. Nothing can exist outside of its system. But that isn't what the Darwinists believe. You want to talk about the development of a certain organ, you know, ears or whatever. You can't just talk about that. You have to talk about everything in its environment. Something isn't going to develop unless it has a connection, not just to the world around it, but to the whole system of the organism itself. And to the point where you get such complexity that the theory falls to pieces. I mean, DNA is just, you know, an extreme example of how poorly thought out. And of course, Darwin existed prior to the discovery of that. This ridiculously complex thing, these interrelations that are, you know, really beyond the capacity to picture all at one time, just a level of information that couldn't have developed. It may have gotten more complicated, I guess, but the system itself couldn't have developed, or else nothing could have reproduced. So these are just, you know, examples of the fact that knowledge can't be based just on grouping qualities together because it's interesting or it's just an easy way to remember things. No, the species are real. One species doesn't become another one, but it does change, of course, within its own essence. But the word essence is the center. And an essence can't be physical, you know, that, you know, the catness is to be found in all cats, but it still exists on its own. So, and that goes for everything, you know, natural law, which I guess we all believe in, which itself leads to, you know, community and family and nation, all being the fundamental building blocks of society. Had to have existed at the same time man was created, as you already mentioned. You know, my talk yesterday on Mao's Great Leap Forward, I mentioned the Sparrows campaign, and I brought that up on purpose. It's kind of funny, but that's the most extreme version of nominalism imaginable. Well, the crops are being eaten, so let's kill all the birds. And no one noticed that you can't remove one species from the ecosystem without total chaos occurring. It's not just that. It's all these interconnections. And so the bugs multiplied beyond belief because that's what the sparrows eat. And that ended up being worse than before. But you throw this balance off and you have nothing. And the ontological status of that system, because it had to have existed at the same time these things were created, it doesn't make any sense otherwise, is basically what we call the form of something. It's a deep interrelation. It's like you call it the human body. It is this tremendously complicated makeup of everything from genetics to our organs to our thought processes, understanding natural law and everything else. That interconnectedness as a universal object had to have existed either before or at the same time that this was created. So you got it absolutely right in stressing that aspect of it.
Well, I just found it absolutely fascinating. I mean, I'm not a philosophy student. I didn't go to university. And yet I found that I was able to understand the book. I did end up using the dictionary a couple of times, just looking up a couple of words. But mainly I could understand what was going on from the context of what was being talked about there. And I did find it absolutely fascinating. And lots of other things that sort of tied in with it. And you go through these various church fathers and what they added to this theory, Grosseteste's theory of light and the way that light used to be looked at. I found that particularly fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I know you did a podcast on this as well. Can you summarize the way that light is not just what we see, the light that's coming from the sun or whatever, or the daylight, but light as in actual knowledge and understanding of an object. That is also light as well. I believe that's what you were trying to get across. Can you sort of talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the church fathers, and including, you know, Orthodox writers up until today, the word light is used constantly. And, it's in the Bible as well. Of course, it's a literal light that comes from the sun. But especially given the intellectual context of the time, which is far richer than ours, because ours is everything is reduced to its most basic literal form. That is not how science was viewed in the past. Light has so many deeply symbolic elements. The sun, it's a masculine. It's a gold. It's permanent. It's reason. Going back to the dawn of civilization. It's just strange how the dawn of civilization had all of these very advanced concepts already in existence, at least the earliest writings we could ever get our hands on, like Gilgamesh or whatever. But there is he was the founder of the science of optics. The fact that he was a bishop in Lincoln in the high Middle Ages is very impressive. This is where the scientific method came from. The scientific method is perfectly fine, so long as it stays within its boundaries. The minute it starts talking about things like freedom or consciousness, they fall apart. That is not, the simple cause and effect that science is based on. But he developed an entirely new sense of physics, that light is rarefied matter, and then as it stretches out over the cosmos, it consolidates itself in the center, which is where the Earth is. Now, the details aren't as significant of the fact that light is also usually translated as grace, even virtue. You can't see anything or know anything in front of you unless there's light to light it up. So fathers would talk about light as the presence of the divine nature on Earth. We could finally come to understand what things are. Plato was the greatest philosopher of all time. Church fathers took him very seriously. He can only go so far, of course, despite the fact that he rejected the advanced paganism of his era, rejected how the gods were depicted, and one of the things that got him killed at the end. But the form, the universal essence of something, a system, or is itself light. His whole allegory of the cave was the fact that people are trapped in this cave. They only see what's put in front of their face, and they have no idea what the sun is. That sun are these forms. It's this understanding. Somebody escapes the cave, and they're blinded by the sun. They don't know what to do with it. It's almost painful. But they know they have to go back into the cave and say, no, there's this reality out here that's being kept from us. Light is everywhere. In this mentality, it's one of the most powerful symbols of Western civilization. Today, though, no one thinks in those terms. If they're thinking in those terms, it's because they're hearkening back to a much earlier time. But in general, light is that which you turn on in your house, and it's really nothing more than that. So these weren't just literal categories. Because of the systems, the systemic nature of reality, we use metaphors and symbols. Symbol is not the opposite of substance. It's an introduction to substance. We call it realism because these forms, which are not material, they are eternal. They're found in Logos, the second person of the Trinity, as you mentioned. This is through which all things were created. Logos essentially took Plato's forms and synthesized them into what we call the divine nature, at least as far as creation is concerned. If you believe in creation, then you can't believe in nominalism. It's in many ways the mind of God manifests via creation, the limited piece of it that we have any access to. And also, to fully be aware of our limitations. We're born and raised in a world of matter. The individual things that we want to dominate or have or control. But it takes a great amount of struggle, which is why I chose the Church Fathers as my vehicle here, because they were first-rate metaphysicians, and it's not often that they're treated that way. Of course, they were theologians, but because of all of these debates and battles, they had to develop their version of Platonic metaphysics, especially when you talk about John's Gospel, the Word made flesh. Well, you can't talk about the Word making flesh, becoming flesh, unless you believe in these universal realities. Word isn't just like a word on a page. It's the structure of reality. They use, and the interesting thing about early Christianity was they took extremely difficult concepts and brought it down to the level of the common person. You didn't have to be one of the chosen philosophers in Plato's world to understand this. That's where the icons come from, and the sacred music and the liturgy. That's why these are sacred. you go through the liturgy, the church calendar, you'll see the systems of reality, even in the architecture, manifest. The peasant of the Middle Ages was far more attuned to symbolism than anyone today. They would call moderns illiterate because they don't know how to read these symbols. It's immensely complicated ideas and systems being brought to the level of reality through poetry and everything else. There's a million ways to get to this, but of course not everyone is a philosopher. So this is where the icon and all this kind of thing comes from. So you're right. And the first thing you mentioned, you talked about systems. Systems are far more fundamental than the parts of the systems. The parts don't make a whole lot of sense outside of the system. And of course, from there, talking about nationalism as a part of natural law is really easy. The whole has to come first. The parts only make sense because they're part of the whole of something. And that's how we come to know things, not through the empirical methods of what we will abbreviate things that look alike by calling them a name. That's a human creation. That's just what's convenient for us at the moment. It's not actual knowledge.
Yeah, of course, the way that things are today, it tries to separate us from the whole, doesn't it? Our whole science just looks at things separated and as individual objects rather than as a part of everything else. And from that, we try to come out with this idea of evolution, and we just get further and further distance from the actual truth of things, which I think is how people used to look at things. And then you make a point that all these pagan ideas and all these different gods, how they end up arising after this confusion of what reality actually is. Do you want to go into a little bit about that and how these pagan ideas of gods? Because one part of it was that none of them actually create. They basically just change the things that are already there, which is something that I noticed about the Anunnaki. They end up just messing around with the creation that's already here. That none of them actually create. And there's a reason for that as well. Do you want to go into that for a bit?
Well, you know, I've been talking about this for a long time. Deriving straight from Plato, terms like pagan are very, very vague. It doesn't really refer to a theology. Gods can be seen, they weren't ever meant to be, and Plato got in trouble for saying this with the common people, that they weren't actually meant to be actual individuals. These were symbols of like Apollo and the sun and reason, etc. But it is a decay from the concept of the one center from which everything derives. The system of systems, the foundation of reason rather than reason itself. And you're right to mention the essentially titans of the Old Testament. You know, titans were the great architect. Well, an architect doesn't create the materials. The concept of something coming from nothing had to be imported from Central Asia. The idea of zero, you didn't see this in Roman math. There is no zero in Roman numerals. The concept of a symbol being more than what it's meant to denote, it was absurd to most people. When Christians said that God created out of nothing, it was and promoted this. It was striking. The Jews didn't care about that at the time, and certainly with the Sadducees who were materialists, and so it was a really radical idea. The whole concept of something coming from nothing. The gods are meant to be a very complicated poetic symbols of either a social or a natural reality. This is what Plato said. This is what got him into trouble. The word pagan, we may use it just as a, I guess at the time too, in early Christianity, it was seen, St. Augustine of Canterbury was told that, if these customs were useful, then keep them. And most of them were fairly healthy. Now, when I'm talking about that term in the book, I'm referring mostly to the Kabbalah, this perversion of that. St. Augustine ripped that stuff to pieces. And Augustine really went on and on and on about this in his City of God. To a certain extent, they're healthy if you understand them not as actual people, not as actual human entities living on a mountain somewhere. they're you know, in and of themselves, they're harmless, because if you understand them, and the fact that there was no dogma, there was no doctrine, these stories were always changing. There's a million versions of the same story. And that wasn't important. It didn't matter. They weren't actual, you know, literal realities, but they were a very powerful poetic description of how things came to be. And of course, they had plenty of errors, just like Plato did. But in and of themselves, if you get rid of this pagan as a religion stuff, you know, these gods were not like Yahweh. They didn't function that way. They weren't seen as that. They didn't create. They only used stuff that was already present. That's what the great architect ultimately comes down to. Creation out of nothing, that is a completely different idea.
One of the other parts that I just had a personal question about was when you were talking about Solomon's temple. Now, I'm used to thinking of Solomon, the wisdom of Solomon, the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament, and he's looked up to by the church. Yet at the same time, he had different wives. And I know that there is apocryphal literature, maybe Jewish literature, which talks about Solomon using demons. But as far as I was aware, what it talks about in the Bible is that the temple that he built was the temple of Yahweh. Yet when you're talking about it in the book, you're talking about it as if it's something that's not good, and you bring in these aspects that Solomon was using demons and what have you. So I wondered if you could just sort of clear that up for me, because I'm used to thinking the temple was built, it was a good temple, it was meant to be built for Yahweh, it was built correctly. Yet in your book, you seem to be talking about it in a rather negative sense. So could you explain that for us, please?
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's been a huge issue for me for a long time. As far as the canonical Old Testament is concerned, Solomon died a heretic. He died denying Yahweh and bringing pagan gods into the temple. God gave him many chances to repent, and he refused. Israel was supposed to be a light to the nations. It was supposed to be a different kind of political mentality. But because it was small, and because they were a small empire at the time, Solomon had to, or believed he had to, start making deals with the surrounding powers. Well, you can't sign a treaty at the time without putting their symbols, these patron gods and goddesses, in your own political center. And of course, in that case, it was the temple. The temple was loaded with all of these deities and these governments with which he had signed treaties. And he was condemned. He was condemned by the prophets at the time. That you can't do this. You can't make deals with people who are inherently our enemies. These are all, you know, these aren't, they don't worship Yahweh. They don't understand. They care about money and power. And now apparently you do too. Taking pagan wives, which was condemned all over the Old Testament, as you well know. And despite the fact, and of course, yes, he used forced labor. He radically vulgarized the initial constitution, so to speak, of the Israelite state. He became, or was trying to become, just like the nations surrounding him, believing that the only way to survive was to make deals with all of these people, and hence slowly adopt their point of view. And yet today, from the dawn of the church, Solomon is depicted with a halo. And I brought this up with a few bishops who I respect, and the only answer I've ever gotten is that David must have somehow interceded for him in such a way that he was forgiven, and you know, because he wrote so many wonderful things. But then, as he got older, he fell away. Isaiah was in the exact same position. He said, "No, you can't make deals with Babylon or Egypt, because that means you're going to have to adopt some of their ways of thinking." And that's one of the reasons he was driven out. One of the reasons he was eventually murdered. In other words, politics, money, this belief that our future can only be understood if we were wealthy and one of the nations was rejected. This is the big issue that the prophets had. And after Solomon's death, there were rebellions. Israel was split in two, and you know, the Israelites never recovered from Solomon. So I guess I'm willing to believe that. Clearly, the church has always viewed him as a legitimate prophet, despite him clearly dying a heretic. But I know a few bishops have said, well, David must have fixed that somehow. He couldn't have been this wonderful and this important But he did make tremendous mistakes, and he died unrepentant as far as the Old Testament is concerned. So I'm willing to accept that. But well, the temple, of course, was a, you know, God dictated its dimensions and everything. That's not how it was by the time he died. Paganism ruled the realm at the time. And of course, as always, the prophets were the only ones who were willing to step in. And of course, he rejected it. No matter how many times he was called to repentance, he refused. But I'm willing to accept that he – and then, of course, you know, later on, the Masons took Solomon's temple as their primary symbol. And of course, they're not talking about the temple in the good sense. They're talking about what Solomon made of it near the end of his life. That's what they think is wonderful, not the concept of the temple. You know, so and Solomon, and so if it gets resurrected at the end of days, it's going to be the pagan version or the Kabbalistic version, rather than the actual true version in the Old Testament. So there's two different ways of using the word temple in this sense.
Well, that really does clear it up, especially they're bringing in the Masons, because they obviously they talk about this temple all the time in these positive terms, and also I guess that would be where this architect bit comes in as well, possibly. So when you're talking about this, I mean, how would you describe it? Because you talk about it being described as realism in the book, and you make a lot of references to Plato. So would this be Neoplatonism? Would it be realism? Is it? I mean, you call it patristic philosophy in the book. So, I mean, is there an overarching term that describes this worldview at all?
Yeah, as the centuries went on, it took on different names. But in the Middle Ages, they settled on realism. And it is very confusing because you use the word realism in a thousand other ways. That's why I use a capital R. And the theory basically is that the things that are real, things you could actually know, and that knowledge is permanent, can't be material, because material things are always changing. This was a cardinal principle of Plato. Material cannot be, or matter can't be, the foundation of knowledge. And if you want to discuss it, you have to discuss what's permanent about it. But of course, matter inherently isn't. But the laws that govern matter are. So automatically, you're in a spiritual realm or a non-material realm. That non-material realm is the real world. Well, we live in a variation of it. We're surrounded by corruption and decay and death. We have access to it. We have access to it as Plato saw, you know, through a reason. But of course, it was Christ, especially the Council of Chalcedon, centuries later, that made it what it was and brought it down to the level of the average person. So the material world isn't the real one. The spiritual world is. Nominalism, of course, refers to things that are nominal or named. And it refers to the fact that for that, you know, group of people from the sophists in the ancient world to, you know, industrialists today, the only things that exist are names. Hence the name nominalism. So I do have always thought that the term realism is very confusing. But I use a capital R. In the very beginning of the book, I explain all the different terms that you can use, and that's why I use a capital to say that this is a specific proper noun referring to a school of thought. Saint Justin Martyr referred to himself as a Christian Platonist. Plato made many errors, of course. He didn't have any access to. St. Justin does say he had some connection with some of the Mosaic writings, the very early writings, but the wisdom of the ancient. I shouldn't say Mosaic, and that's the center of it. We don't accept the errors. Neoplatonism ended up being a form of magic. And it was condemned by the church. It really wasn't Plato. It was a decay of Platonic ideology. It was a very easy system to corrupt. But it was as close to reality as unaided human reason can get. So it was the very first time I came across a defense of the spiritual world. And it changed everything. Christian Platonist. to understand that the Christian part of it corrects Plato's errors. But he did erect the system that the early church fathers used. St. Justin Martyr couldn't have been more Platonic. What became what was called technically Neoplatonism centuries later was essentially this kind of magical, using words and incantations. That had nothing to do with Platonism. It was rightly condemned. It was simply a decay of the Platonic system and the Platonic Academy. What they called Platonism, even in the Renaissance, what they called Platonism was that magical view of it, not the intellectual view. So correcting Plato's errors is very important. We don't take him as a whole, but in terms of describing the structure of the spiritual world, he was absolutely critical. They used his language, they used his arguments, but that was as far as unaided human reason could go, 2,500 years ago.
And does the Orthodox Church talk about these sort of things? Is that the general worldview that the Orthodox Church has today, or is this something from the earlier Orthodox Church that you've particularly concentrated on?
Well, the church is supposed to be based not just on the scriptures, but their interpretation from the church fathers. That's why they came into existence. Some of these men were responsible for putting the Bible together in the first place. And so their descriptions of things are normative for the most part. They were far from perfect, but this is how we approach the Old and the New Testament and the early years of the church. The term Platonism and Orthodoxy is very controversial because it can refer to several different things. As I said, Neoplatonism was condemned because it was a form of essentially pagan magic. And that's what was condemned. So people sometimes get confused as to who Plato is. People who, there's a handful of very good philosophers in the Orthodox world who understand this. There was an entire Greek movement against it. The John Romanides, who I think is one of the reasons I started writing this book in the first place, because of the errors that he made, that there really is no connection between man and God. There is no grounds for connection, which was, in my opinion, an awfully heretical idea. And and this was William of Ockham had a very similar argument. He even said that he was kind of the founder of at the end of the Middle Ages, of this nominalist school. I think he gave it its name, saying, yes, the archetypes of existence exist in God, but we have no access to them because there's no human nature and divine nature are so different from one another that there is no way for these things to connect. But that's the very nature of the incarnation. So Ockham says, well, we don't really know this, so we believe it purely on faith, which is very vulgar, and it's not true. And it was a debasement of, Christianity is fully amenable to reason. It does make sense. It holds together intellectually. But I don't think there are many anymore who understand how that actually works.
Well, faith is based upon reason, isn't it? I mean, it's not blind faith, is it? I mean, faith is a confidence that a promise is going to be kept. And your faith is based upon, your reason. When you look around the world at the natural order and you see all these systems that are within it, that as you pointed out here, the system of the systems is the Logos. That's Christ, and that's God acting throughout everything and the orderly mind that we can know from that. I mean, people understand I'm a student of Christian identity. I think Christian identity has the historical aspects of the Bible correct, but I think this Orthodox idea here, they've definitely got the metaphysics of it all correct. I mean, that's the way that it seems to me. It's an absolutely fantastic book. I found it easier to read than Dr. E. Michael Jones' Logos book. So listeners that aren't into philosophy, anything like that, I think they probably still find it a really interesting book. I would definitely give it 10 out of 10, Matt, but I do think you should bring out a second version with a glossary. A glossary would definitely be good. But I'll leave it up to you to just give us a final word before we finish today.
Well, the struggle was, how do I take ancient metaphysics and make it accessible? I tried to define a few terms in the introduction, but I think you're right. In fact, it may be worth an entire Orthodox nationalist to go through some of these terms because, and I do say this in the introduction, there's over the centuries, many, many terms have come to refer to the same thing. So I think that's an excellent idea. A glossary might be important. The exception to that is, of course, you know, the sales have been excellent, and I've had first rate reviews. That's one of the reasons this has been a good year for me. But I think you're right. Who knows how many editions of this thing there are going to be? But our listeners have supported me in this respect, and I really appreciate it.
Well, it does definitely deserve to be a bestseller. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. We have a patriotic history on at the same time tomorrow, and we have a special New Year's Eve mix on New Year's Eve for you. So, as I say, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for sticking with us throughout the year. I will be back on Monday. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.